Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
You do it this time.
Can I do it like I did it before?
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
We're your hosts, Kimberly and Kara. Thank you for joining us.
I felt like a 1-900 operator.
It's so important.
Keep it in.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Well, welcome to our very professional podcast. Today, we're very excited to host an actual professional.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the contrast might be stark, but you also love us for us, hopefully. And hopefully you are here for us and our realness, and we're just going to show up. And also, you know, here's the thing. Kim and I may be having a little bit of stress right now, and maybe we act a little extra ridiculous as a means of relieving stress. How you doing, Kim?
You know, I've been better. And I say this as I'm watching our new foster puppy walk down the hallway where he is sure to pee on the floor.
He just has anxiety. You know, he has stage fright. He doesn't want to go in front of you.
I think this one might have a smooth brain. He's super sweet, though.
We love a smooth brain dog around here. I also have a smooth brain dog with a rotten tooth because he eats rocks and logs. And now our choices are to get a dog root canal. Or get it just straight up pulled, or get him a titanium tooth. Because what's more terrifying than a Belgian Malinois with metal teeth? I can't think of one.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I didn't tell you this. Yeah, it's
no.
He's not even a year and a half old, and we looked at his tooth the other day, and it's like gray. We're like, why is our dog's tooth gray? Joe's like, oh, I did notice that it. He cracked it recently, and I was like. What? Because for the people who don't know, my dog picks up like 40-pound logs with his teeth.
Just the trees.
We try not to let him do it, but trying to not let a Malinois do something is, it's pointless. Anyway, yeah, so now we get to take him to the vet and get his tooth pulled. We're not getting a dog root canal. Let's just be real clear about that. He's not getting a root canal, and he's also not getting a $5,000 metal tooth. So if you look at my dog and he's got snaggle teeth, mind your business. That's all I gotta say.
Okay, well, Lana did have a root canal.
Stop it. Yes. Oh, Lana.
We don't know how long. Like, it was bad back there.
Oh, it was a back tooth.
Yeah, and she's never been a chewer on anything.
That's different.
I think they just left it.
This is a canine, so I'm like, he doesn't need that. He doesn't rip his food apart anymore. It's gone. So
the mighty descendants of wolves with titanium teeth and a dental bill.
Oh my God, so ridiculous. You know, just adding to the stress. It's fine.
Well, you've heard before that one of my coping mechanisms right now is foster dogs. So I drove down to the rescue in a blizzard to pick up a dog that refuses to go to the bathroom outside. You know, this blizzard. Is the kind of opposite of serotonin right now, but he's super sweet and cuddly and absolutely loves the kids. Not a biter, not a barker, but he does do this little like,
yeah,
I'm here.
Ty made him do that on FaceTime the other day. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. They just wanted to talk. Tell us about your coping mechanisms right now.
On Saturday, I may or may not have spent close to 2 hours on my skin. I make no apologies. Don't ask me what I did or how, but you know, I'm glowing, so I feel like it's okay. And then I spent the rest of the day in my hammock reading a book, getting covered in pollen. So what's healthier? I don't know.
You know what I've been thinking about this whole time, though, as we talk through our days? It's the little things that are compounding. And I just keep thinking, you know, the trauma bucket and stuff. And it's all these little things when we're also carrying a lot of big trauma that are just eating me right now. And one of them, Dr. Seuss week was last week. And I think I told you this. One of the days was crazy sock day. It was Monday. And we pull up to school and all the kids are walking into school in these crazy socks. And my two are looking at me like, Mommy, we forgot. It's crazy sock day. Well, I got an email from the teachers the week prior about Dr. Seuss day. And I didn't open it or at least didn't register. It's like I'll read something and I mentally respond or log it away, which actually just means that it goes to a fiery place. There's right. never another thought about it. And it was just in that moment that I was like, that got buried under all of this manufactured BS that no one should have to deal with. And while the kids don't know the difference, to them, they're just missing crazy sock day. But to me, I missed their crazy sock day. And they have two different meanings. And it's just, bleh. So anyway, I went and got a dog.
I mean, sounds normal. It's death by 1,000 paper cuts, right?
Yeah. It just is yuck. But then we have positive news too.
Yeah. So my TikTok has blown the frick up.
Just in time for it to get shut down, allegedly, again.
Go ahead, U.S., try to ban it. Katie, the actress who plays me, Katie Douglas, has like an absolute cult following. And the youths have arrived on my TikTok. And they ask a lot of questions. And I am trying my best to catch up and keep up. And yeah, I hit 500,000, half a million on TikTok Friday, which is so bizarre to me. So maybe I will actually get some consistent views and kind of upgraded in the algorithm differently. If you find this interesting, then let me know, because I can't keep up with it. I don't even begin to understand. I'm trying.
My sweet little niece, who is 13, called, she FaceTimed after we watched the movie because she was watching while it was on live. And she called, she's like, Auntie, do you know Katie Douglas? I'm like, no, but guess who does? Kara. And like, just the meltdown mode with her and her friend that were there. Like, that is what all of the youths are going through and experiencing when they see this person who's of a similar age and they're playing a role that they really like. And then they can follow them online and learn more about them through you. And it's just so wild and also hilarious. But I've had to do some comment warrioring.
I know. Well, and I keep viewing it through the lens of myself at that age and even myself 15 years ago. And I did some things that were not smart. And so I'm just trying to be a mom. Someone said I had this video where I responded to, it was literally a TikTok video of me talking about the movie with the name of the movie in the caption, in the video, it was everywhere. And someone said, what's the name of the movie? And I did this video that was just kind of like, and a couple people were like, oh gosh, the attitude. But one person was like, this gives me disappointed mom vibes. And I was like, there it is. Maybe I just need to find what my vibe is. I was like, it's disappointed mom vibes. Like, did you put on sunscreen today? Because you have to wear it every day.
Or the eye widening look, like the mouth downturned.
Yeah, like, no, and the stare, like the, you know what you did. So it doesn't necessarily work on my kids, but maybe it'll work on other kids.
But I would also like to point out that it wasn't just me as a teenager that was really embarrassing, because I'm thinking about me at 22 years old trying to find Robert Pattinson's MySpace account and like follow all the things on MTV about Twilight. Oh my God.
And dressing up as Kim Possible.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. You should text me right now because I have my ringer on. This is really important. Kara was followed recently by Christy Carlson Romano.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know.
If you don't know who she is, it's Kim Possible and Even Stevens, right?
Yeah, she was in Even Stevens. Yep.
She follows me and she commented on one of my videos and I was like, screenshotted it and sent it to Kim and she was like, shut up, and immediately sends me these photos of her dressed up as Kim Possible. And she was like, you do know what my text ringtone is, don't you?
My 18th birthday party was a Kim Possible party.
We have to put these on show notes.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's at least the Kim Possible cake. But I think we should put the cosplay in too.
Oh, I'm down. I don't. Do I come across as someone who has any shame at all? Absolutely.
Not particularly. No.
Yeah. I've always loved Kim Possible. And that was my nickname on my Powderpuff jersey. And pretty great. So, yeah, we all kind of do silly, stupid things in our youth that most people, it's just cringe and move on.
And they don't have it held against them.
No, thank God YouTube didn't exist when we were kids. But for some people, it didn't matter if YouTube or social media or whatever else was even around, because international media surrounds sins and creates their own character, their own persona, their own storyline. And that's what leads us to today's guest. She was one of the first ones that I knew for sure when Kara and I started talking about this that we wanted to have on, because her perspective is so unique. And the difference between us as survivors, Amanda herself is also a survivor, and you'll hear more about why, but she didn't just survive having the media take her story and run with it, but she was painted as the villain, a stigma that still persists today. All you have to do is go look at some of her comments, and it's horrifying, but I think that her incredible journalism career, her push to maintain ethics and actually taking part in so many different places within her community and on a national scale is incredible. She could have just changed her name and run away and never wanted to peek out again. Instead, she took this awful experience and is making it into something that will help others.
Yeah, I think that's the epitome of going beyond being a survivor of these things and fighting for other people who have been through similar or even different situations that you can understand in some way, shape, or form. So we loved this conversation and we hope you love it as much as we do. And here it is. Here's Amanda.
Today's guest is Amanda Knox. As you may know, Amanda is an exoneree, journalist, public speaker, and author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Waiting to be Heard. Between 2007 and 2015, she spent nearly 4 years in an Italian prison and 8 years on trial for a murder she didn't commit.
Amanda and her husband, Christopher, produce and host Labyrinths, a podcast about the winding, unexpected paths in people's lives.
She's a featured contributor to CrimeStory.com, where she interviews other leaders in the criminal justice reform movement.
She also routinely helps raise money for the Innocence Project and currently sits on the board of the Frederick Douglass Project for Justice, whose mission is to humanize the incarcerated. I am so excited to bring you our guest. This is someone that when we decided that we were going to do a podcast around true crime and survivors and ethics and media, we knew that this was someone that we definitely wanted to talk to. So I am so happy to introduce you guys to Amanda Knox.
Hey, thanks for having me. We had the opportunity to meet a little while back, but we are just excited to be able to chat with you a little bit, pick your brain, have you talk to our listeners.
Heck yeah.
Yes.
Sounds great. Let's do it.
Okay. So we have a question that we start off all of our interviews with. What is your current binge, whether it's a TV series, book? What have you been watching a ton of?
This is going to sound so basic, but The Great British Baking Show. It's just like so easy to turn on when I'm holding a bottle in a baby's mouth. It's just like there. And like, I'm actually not even much of a baking person, but I appreciate the art of someone else. I would love to see a craft show like that as well.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Have you seen Nailed It?
No. What's that?
Oh my God. Oh my God. Imagine The Great British Baking Show, but except everything has gone terribly wrong.
Like, it's you that goes on it. Like, because you said you're not a good baker, right? Like, you're not talking about, so it's literally like the most average people, and they give them these gigantic, extravagant things. And they're like, you're going to make a 12-layer cake with a man climbing a waterfall, and you have 2 hours to do it. They're so bad. If you want like something that you can laugh at, it's British Bake Off. And you just watch it, you're like, what happened?
It's so amazing. And it's kid friendly too.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fun. The one thing I like about the Great British Baking Show is it does seem like it's setting up everyone to succeed, even if it is a challenge. Mm-hmm. I kind of feel like I don't as much enjoy watching those shows that like set people up to fail.
Yeah.
But I hear you.
I think they go into it knowing, though, the auditions are, this is how bad I am. I can barely cook chicken nuggets in the oven.
It's full on like people laughing at themselves where they're like, I nailed it. Oh, honey.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I'd be curious to know actually like how people feel about it afterwards, because I've seen some really, I mean, have you guys met Christine Marie Cottas?
No.
Oh, my. Well, she is somebody who does research into media trauma. So like the kind of traumatic impact media exposure can have to be, and specifically related to either true crime or reality TV shows.
Oh,
how people
God.
Like go into reality TV shows like Big Brother, for example,
yeah.
and they're sort of set up to look like idiots. And then they go into it thinking, oh, this will just be fun and I'll get famous. And then they come out of it with like a tremendous amount of baggage and trauma that she's yeah. done a lot of really cool research into. So if you want, I can connect you afterwards,
yes,
because
please.
She's like got her PhD in that. And I've never heard of anyone doing that extent of research.
That is exactly what we would love to hear more of.
Yeah, she would be the expert.
To lead off. Oh my gosh. Yes. That would be incredible.
Why are you even talking to me right now? Like...
Well, to that end, to your comfort level, Amanda, tell us and the listeners a little bit about your story from your perspective, what you're comfortable with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm famously the girl who was accused of murder. And there are a lot of girls that are accused of murder out there, but I was the one that was studying abroad, and my roommate was brutally raped and murdered just out of nowhere, it seemed. And instead of the police focusing on the actual evidence and the clues that showed that it was a local burglar who had broken into our home and raped and murdered my friend, they instead focused their entire investigation on me and presented a theory of the case, which was this like female on female, like sexual hatred, and just this insane femme fatale storyline that for some reason captured the public's imagination for nearly a decade. And I was supposed to be just a footnote in that story, just the roommate of the girl who was horribly raped and murdered. And instead, I became the focus of the entire case. So that was back in 2007 when I was 20 years old, and I spent 4 years in prison and a total of 8 years on trial.
Every time I am left speechless as to how this could happen. And it seemed to me at that time, because I'm the same age, like it's happening in a world so far away and it's something that can never happen to you, but it is. All of these crimes that we discuss here absolutely could happen to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the thing that's really shocking about all of our experiences is how fragile we all are, and not just individually as human beings, but also collectively as a society, how we get like wrapped up in these narratives or in these ideas about people so easily and without much need of evidence or prompting even. And that's just because we're casually absorbing a lot of narratives in our lives already. And then when the media sort of, or the criminal justice system sort of picks people up and slips them into these very easily recognizable slots, we just sort of assume, oh, okay, that's exactly how it is. And I think that our criminal justice system, unfortunately, relies way too much on narrative and not enough on evidence. And that's to the detriment of everyone, because what it means is in a courtroom, these professional people are crafting stories about the worst experiences of people's lives. And they're oftentimes absolutely just making stuff up about victims, about defendants, about all of this stuff, crafting a story that's palatable to people. And it's, I think, one of the most shocking revelations for me from my whole experience was how little it seemed the truth mattered to people once they had sort of latched on to a story that was what people really held on to. And that's been sort of my experience also in the aftermath of all of this, is like how much the narratives that we first hear about people impact our ability to even see them as human beings. And that goes for everyone who's been touched by the criminal justice system. So we really need to be mindful about how we are representing people, especially in these incredibly traumatic experiences that are going to resonate no matter what in those people's lives for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And to what you said, I watched your documentary, and one of the things that stood out to me is how this entire narrative that was crafted around you was focused on how you responded to this very traumatic event. It was, well, she's not responding the way someone who has experienced something traumatic should respond, right? And so I'm using air quotes. Yeah. Right. And that just struck me. And it really just kind of, I mean, it made my heart hurt for you, because I was like, first of all, there is no normal response to an abnormal situation. There is no normal. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to remember that there are a million ways that people could respond. And you were just sort of convicted in this court of public opinion because of the way you responded. And I just found that so interesting. Do you want to talk about
that? Yeah, you know, I can talk about that. Yeah, because it's interesting how much focus has been, like you said, on my behavior basically from November 2nd, 2007, which was the day that Meredith's body was discovered, and November 6th, which is when I was arrested. So that we have a time frame of 4 days, 5 days, in which I was being questioned on and off by the police for 53 hours. So around 10 hours a day, I was being questioned by the police in the Questura, the police office. And you're right. Not every, like, there isn't just this one way to respond to a traumatic situation. And I do think that in some ways, my reaction was different than other people's. Another thing to remember, though, is that every single person who arrives at a crime scene and discovers this unfolding of information, which is not just obvious from the get-go. Like, I think one of the things that has really been a difficult journey for me is explaining to people, well, when I came home that day, I was not expecting to find a crime scene. Right. Like, right. In retrospect, we can all say, well, there was a crime scene. Didn't you notice? And it's like, well, I didn't see a body. I didn't see pools of blood. And in fact, I never, ever saw Meredith's body in person. I never saw what inside her room where she was murdered. I saw the sort of after, like, if we call that ground zero, I had these sort of after impact space where the murderer had left traces of himself within our house, but I never actually saw the crime scene itself. And so I think that was one sort of challenge for me, was explaining to people, like, I know in retrospect, everyone looking back goes, how could you not realize that there was a crime scene? And how could you not emote and respond as if you had just seen a body, you had just witnessed a murder? And it's like, well, I didn't. Yeah, that's why I wasn't reacting that way, is because I didn't see. And everybody who did discover the crime scene, everyone, like, we called the police when we noticed that someone had broken into our house. When the police arrived, when my roommates arrived, they were the ones who broke down Meredith's door, and they were the ones who saw what happened. And everyone in that space was a fluent Italian speaker and started speaking fluent Italian very rapidly. And so me, as someone who was not fluent in Italian, did not understand what people were saying. And so again, like, there's a lot of, like, hyper focus on my behavior in those days, as if I had all of the information about the horror that had been unveiled. Mm-hmm. And I did not. All of that information came to me in piecemeal and in a broken language that I was trying to put together. But on top of that, I also feel like it's kind of like the discussion about my behavior is a little bit of a retroactive smokescreen to, like, justify having gone out of their way to, like, as a way of saying, well, we don't want to admit fault for having arrested an innocent young girl, so we're going to find reasons retroactively to say that she was off and that we were justified in arresting her, which is not uncommon in cases of wrongful convictions, where they try to find ways to blame the victim for having been targeted by the police. So,
well, and let's talk about that ground zero, because you were a victim from that point. You know, a lot of people think of, oh, it's only the rape and murder victim, and they focus on that. But sometimes the media narrative, or even people that are working on that case, forget, hey, the roommates or the family, they're also victims. I mean, we call them secondary victims, but they're experiencing the trauma of a home invasion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might have been your reaction. And we don't know what our reactions will be until we're actually in that situation. But I think that that's what's given the entire true crime industry rise, is the idea that we have control. If we consume enough of this media and enough of these stories, then somehow we will have control over how we react. Mm. What have you found when it comes to true crime? And that is a massively loaded question, I know.
Oh, God. Well,
where do we begin?
Yeah. Where do we begin? So I think one thing I should say at the outset is that I was never a true crime person. Like, I know that there are people out there who have always been fascinated by true crime, have read mystery novels, have like gone deep down those things. And in fact, Meredith was one of those people. Like, she liked to read mystery novels, and she was reading stuff like that was true crime related when I knew her. That was not my thing. I was more of a fantasy and like sci-fi nerd. I read poetry and stuff like that. I like to go to classical music concerts. So it wasn't my vibe. And I didn't naturally, I don't intuitively understand the appeal. That said, having been the center of a true crime story and a figure of true crime content creation, it has given me insight into how true crime impacts the people who are at the center of it. I feel like I understand that way more than the consumer side of it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been trying really, really hard to understand the consumer side of it. But in the meantime, my main concern and my main focus has been on, if you find yourself at the center of a true crime story, one, no one chose to be there. And two, how is the way that that content is being created impacting you? Is it furthering your trauma? We talk about like post-traumatic stress. Well, for people whose trauma becomes true crime content, that trauma is not over. You are still experiencing that trauma on a regular basis every time someone brings up the worst experience of your life and decides to dissect it however way that they want to do it. And so it seemed to me like one of the big issues of true crime has been that sense of entitlement. Like,
oh, just, go off.
just the like sense of like, oh, because it's a story out there, I'm entitled to dig into it and tell the story how I see fit, without any self-awareness about
incomplete information.
And with like incomplete information, and it's sort of like relishing the fact that they have incomplete information, because that's where like the mystery and the story arc resides. And it's like, or this is like, I get that all of those things are really tantalizing as a storyteller, but there is another human being on the other side of that story that like so many times that people like the actual storytellers never think to approach the person who has had that experience and is living that experience on a day-to-day basis and might have some very important perspective about that experience. And that perspective might be, you know what? This story doesn't need yet another hot take.
Yes.
I don't know. It's which isn't to say that any of our traumas only belong to us, because they don't. I think we all naturally are a part of a human network of people, and we become interested in other people's stories because of how they impact us, either on a societal level or on a personal level. So it's not that I think that my story only belongs to me. I don't. But that said, I think that if there was like a smidge more humility on the side, on the part of the storyteller's side, they might just ask themselves, does my hot take need to exist?
And I don't think that they're doing it necessarily. Not all of them are doing it with the intent of, they don't have something evil in mind, and it's not like they're acting, but you're so ingrained in this just being normalized now. And I don't even think back in 2007, really, it was as much, because if I think of the options for true crime, it was like, what, Dateline and Unsolved Mysteries, which that one I will still watch. And you actually answered one of our questions. We always ask, do you consume true crime content?
No, I only ever consume true crime content now for the purpose of understanding true crime content. Honestly,
yeah.
Because I feel like I, you know, one of the things that I do on my podcast today is I do tackle true crime related issues, just because by virtue of having been at the center of one, a lot of people who have also found themselves tangential or at the center of true crime stories reach out to me for understanding or to talk through it and want to talk about it. Right. That my podcast is called Labyrinths, and it's about feeling lost. And it's very easy to feel lost in this like true crime landscape. And so I deal with true crime content all the time. And part of the things that I'm trying to unravel is the whole, like, what is up with true crime? Like, I actually have a mini series that's going to be coming out in the new year that's all about, like, the history of true crime, the ethics of true crime, how has it evolved over time? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you knew this, but, like, back in ye old days when true crime content was first arising with the printing press, people would just like make up confessions of people like at the gallows. Like they would print the gallows confessions of people. Oh, another thing that they would do back in the day is because they didn't have like photography yet and they would want the jury to witness the crime scene. They would, if they found a crime scene, they would just leave the bodies there and like anyone could go and view them.
What?
It was like a kind of tourism trade. The whole true crime tourism trade back in ye old like 1800s is like a fascinating subject.
And I always call it trauma porn now, where you're just like taking all that is a whole other level that I had no idea even existed.
And it still exists to this day in a way where like back in the day, they used to auction off like the victim's property or like pieces of evidence from the crime scene. They would just auction it after the crime, like after the trial was over. And they still do that to this day. Like there are specialized auctions for like evidence in cases. Like you can buy like Ted Bundy stuff. Like if you are like that's a whole thing, and it's a whole other like weird niche side of the true crime content world, but it's all a part of it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I don't know about you, but I am feeling extra stressed and I would like to not cut my bangs this time. So how are you currently dealing with your stress?
When I realized that I was going to be reliving my trauma on a very frequent basis, I realized that maybe I needed something to increase my stress resiliency. I was lucky enough to find Cured Nutrition. I unequivocally can say it's changed my life and how I deal with stress. I know that sounds dramatic, but Cured is a brand that is high quality. They are full of CBD, adaptogens, and functional mushrooms. All three of those go into your nervous system and they actually calm your nervous system. So you feel a little bit more like a freight liner in the ocean, not getting rocked by the waves, as opposed to a rowboat getting thrown all over the place. And my favorite, Kim got to try when she was here in South Carolina, are the gummies.
I loved it. And I didn't expect them to taste so good.
They're my favorite for when you're feeling a little extra stress on top of your day. Cured Serenity Gummies have CBD, just like all of the Cured products, but they also have ashwagandha and L-theanine. Together, those three go into your system and they just give you a nice, tranquil feeling.
I'm so excited to learn more about them and try more of their products now that you've got me hooked.
Yes. And for any of our listeners who would like to try Cured, you can go to curednutrition.com. That's C-U-R-E-D, nutrition.com. And you can use code KARA10 to get 10% off your purchase today. That's KARA10, curednutrition.com. Give them a try and let us know what you think.
Well, okay. So tell us more about your mini series. What went into that? How did that develop and come about?
Oh, man, it's actually been a long journey. We've been working on it for 3 years. It's called Blood Money. And it's about, it initially started because I was navigating this really interesting dynamic between impacted people, so survivors of crime, and their fans or the people who spend a lot of time being armchair detectives and like blogging about stuff and yes. and like getting really, really invested in cases. And that really like that really difficult dynamic, because it's not just black and white. Like even in my own case, there were tons of people who were doing armchair detective work. And some of them actually really helped my family out. Like there were some people who just came out of the woodwork who were like data specialists and who offered their services to my family just to help us keep track of court documents. Like if in a world where we are dealing with hundreds and hundreds of pages of court documents, it really made a difference that someone decided to like make a little database about them for us. And of course, that person is also taking that database and discussing it with people online and whatever. But like there are actual practical things that armchair detectives and supporters and fans can do. I mean, even the documentary Don't Fuck with Cats is a great yeah. example of that, yeah. of how like people, like whole communities arise around specific cases that may not necessarily even be huge in the media. Mm-hmm. And they can actually solve cases because they just have this like dogged resilience and this like community effort and like this, it's almost like they're sort of psychological CrossFit, like that everyone's like pulling for each other and pushing each other to do better. And so like there is that sense of like, oh my gosh, if you are an aggrieved family that is struggling with this overwhelming burden of making the case for, you know, your loved one who was raped and murdered or someone who has been accused, whatever it is, that is an incredibly overwhelming experience that no single family can like carry that burden on their own. And so they look to these online communities and rely on these online communities for support. At the same time, it feels a little bit like a devil's bargain, because as soon as you like engage with that community is held to no ethical standards whatsoever and feels incredibly entitled to the worst experience of your life. And especially secondary victims, like let's talk about secondary victims who are not even the victims of the crime itself, but who become the targets of all of these like online sleuths who speculate wildly about like what happened and who's involved and la 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 la, and are they telling the truth, and let's look at their interview and see if they looked weird sideways, and do behavioral analysis and do, you know, handwriting analysis, just like this like never ending churning through of people's lives. And is it worth it? Is it a good thing? Are people self-aware of how they're impacting other people who have no choice but to live through that experience? I think that's the big difference. And mm-hmm. the thing that I try to like hammer down in the miniseries is that question of like, okay, if we're thinking about like, how do we make rules for ethics about true crime? I think the number one takeaway is to remember that some people didn't have a choice.
Yes.
Like some people did not choose to be involved in the true crime community. And those are the people who are the direct victims, the secondary victims of crime.
Yes.
And everyone else has a choice. And that choice comes with responsibility.
I am so looking forward to, do you know where it's going to air and when or anything like that?
Well, it'll air wherever you get your podcasts. And we don't actually have a release date, but we're going to do a bunch of like media slant, like I'll post it on all my social media and stuff like Perfect. That. So
that'll be awesome. So I will agree with what you said. I think Kim and I do not generally consume true crime. When I first was on a call with you, when we connected, I was like, you know, I knew that you were involved in your documentary. And because did you executive produce that?
No, I did not. No, I was just interviewed.
Wow. Oh, so were you involved?
Yeah, yeah.
I did not know.
I had no creative input, no creative control. I was merely, I like everyone else, was just interviewed for it.
Well, see, that's one of the few that I watched because I'm like, oh, well, she's actually speaking for herself in this.
Well, so here's the thing. There were a lot of people who had reached out to me. Yeah, let's talk about it. So here's the normal experience of somebody who's been impacted by crime. Mm-hmm. And it becomes one of those media sensational stories, even when it's it could be a local media sensational story, even if it doesn't get like nationwide or international attention. Like even just local attention can be incredibly overwhelming because suddenly tons of media professionals just crush down upon you, show up outside of your house, outside of your workplace, will like use any means whatsoever to confront you and demand a response from you. And what you'll often hear is, we're doing a story about your case and your story. And if you decide not, this is your chance to tell it. But if you decide not to tell it, we're going to tell it anyway. And it's going to be without your voice. So it's like wink, wink, it's in your best interest to give us everything that we want. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you the number of times that has been pushed at me. And like, I, as a sort of, I don't know, maybe just because I had been on this like international stage for years already, I intuitively felt like that was bullshit. And so I said no to many, 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 many people. In fact, there's even a moment in the documentary where some media guy confronts my dad. He's been staking outside my dad's house. And he's like, you know, this is Amanda's chance to tell her story. She's not going to be a hot commodity later. And my dad, being like the most epic person ever, is like, my daughter is not a hot commodity. Like, she's a human being. So like, I love my dad. I also love that the filmmakers decided to include that moment. I actually asked them about it afterwards and they were like, we had to include it. It was just such a badass moment. And I was like, I know.
That's the kind of response that you think up later in the shower. You're like, oh, I should have said that. And he did it.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I got lucky with, and this is like just I have lots of advice for people who are thinking about telling their story in some kind of media format. Mm-hmm. One other thing that was really interesting about these particular filmmakers who I eventually said yes to was that they were not true crime filmmakers. They didn't have a history of making, you know, PBS documentaries about crime, or they weren't like Dateline people. They weren't Lifetime. Mm-hmm. They were, at the time, they were these two young, scrappy guys who were working with a Danish production company. They had history in making things like Funny or Die videos. Like, they were not like these people who had this like tremendous amount of like true crime, you know, expertise. They'd done a million documentaries. No, they were guys who weren't even true crime people themselves. They were people who were interested in character. Like what they said that they, when they approached me and they were like, look, Amanda, we think your story isn't interesting because of the whodunit aspect. We're interested in the way that stories are told. We want to use your story to show how stories get out of control. Mm-hmm. And that's basically all they told me leading up to this. So I then sat down with them for like 7 hours, just like in a big cold room all by myself, just and they even pared down their production team. I only saw a single one of them in the room with me at any time. Everyone else was behind like a big, blocking view thing. And there were only two other people who were there making sure that the lights and the sound was coming in appropriately. Mm-hmm. And we just talked. And the thing that I thought that clued me into that maybe this was going to be a positive experience was they didn't just interrogate me about what happened. They didn't say like, okay, and then what happened? And then what happened? And then what happened? They asked me what I thought about what happened, how I felt about what was going on at the time. And if I had like, we spent a lot of time just like thinking about it all and like, what did it all mean? And how had I processed it in the meantime? And of course, I was still on trial at the time that I was interviewed for this documentary. So it wasn't over. I was still in the thick of it. But like it absolutely gave me a chance to really feel like how I thought about things and how I felt was really taken into consideration. And I had no idea if they were going to use any of that material in the documentary. It turns out they did. In fact, they used my like musings as a kind of framing device. And that was, I think I had no idea how the rest of the world was going to respond to it. It was the first really, really big thing that I was a part of. I was terrified leading up to the release of the documentary. I honestly had no idea what was going to happen. My experience leading up to that point was any exposure of me always sort of resulted in me being vilified and hated and people calling me a killer and all of that. But what ended up happening is as people started watching, people started reaching out to me on social media. And the biggest comment was, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I treated you like entertainment for years and I didn't even realize that like you were a real human being." And if that's like the takeaway that a true crime documentary can have a survivor, like that's the kind of impact you want to have as a true crime storyteller, is like reminding people that the people who are characters in your story aren't just characters. They're real human beings that could be any one of us. And they deserve dignity. They deserve respect. They deserve compassion.
Yeah. What I'm hearing you say, and kind of what Kim and I talk about, is true crime is best done, obviously, when it considers that there are actual humans with emotions and feelings at the center of these stories that you're consuming, but also when these stories are told kind of for a purpose. Like, why are we telling these stories, right? So your story, you sitting down and telling your story, it's like, well, I was processing, and it was this story about how media did get out of control and how your whole story was really just kind of shaped and controlled by this media influence. And so whenever I was thinking, okay, I think I'm ready to tell my story in a way that I'm proud of, right? Like something I can put up and say, I had a part in this. I'm proud of it. If you want to know my story, here's where you look. Because other people had told my story, and it's like, okay, we're going to tell your story. Would you like to, like you said, would you like to be part of it? And I experienced many different times where, you know, you tell your story, and I would say that my reaction is not what you would consider a normal reaction as well. Because when I tell my story, I tell it like I'm talking to you right now. It's very matter of fact. I was completely dissociated. So there's no emotional connection in my head and my heart to this trauma that I happened. So I would have these interviews, and at the end, you know, they would cut the camera and they would say, okay, now can you retell this part, but can you just inject a little more emotion into it?
Yeah. Can you like cry for us, please?
Right. Yeah. can you show that you're actually impacted by it? And it shut me down, and I didn't want to do anything. And then whenever I got ready to tell my story, I reached out to Elizabeth Smart and I said, you know, this is something I would like to do. Do you have someone that you would recommend? And the production company that I went with, they made me an executive producer on the project. I was involved from day one to the final day. And it was, it kind of touched on one of the things that you mentioned as well, which is this whole idea of secondary victims, which I think we don't focus on in true crime often. So my parents were interviewed. My boyfriend at the time was interviewed. Yeah. And you got to see and even law enforcement, you got to see the trauma that they experienced, even though they weren't primary victims. And I think that's so important that we remember that, yes, there is this primary victim of this story that we're telling who did not get to choose, who this is the worst day of their life. And then there's also this ripple effect, this secondary ring and this tertiary ring of people who are impacted that we may not be considering as humans. And so I don't know if there's a question in there. I don't think there is, but
yeah, there's no, it's a wonderful observation, because that is 100% true. And I think that you are right, that not enough consideration is given to you know, if we're thinking like who's the primary victim and then there's the secondary victim, but then there's the people even around the secondary victim who, like, in, if we're thinking like in my own case, Meredith is the primary victim, I'm a secondary victim, well, my family is a tertiary victim, mm-hmm. like right. all of these people have had their lives completely uprooted because of the trauma that befell victim number one. Right. And one that shows like how deep the hurt is from whatever the crime that took place, but also like those people who find themselves on the fringes, first of all, would trade places with the person who is a ring in closer to the trauma. Like if my mom could have gone to prison for me, she 100% would have. And she couldn't. She, like, that's one of the horrible things about this experience is no one can take the crime that happened to you away. They can't even like share the burden of that crime. It's like even the fact that like they didn't experience it, but no, you did, is itself a kind of trauma. Like I, as a mom, I 100% understand that now. Like if anything were to befall my daughter, I would 100% want to have experienced it for her, and I can't. And that's something that is, it's such an existential crisis that anyone who goes through this experience goes through. Because as someone who is a victim or a secondary victim of crime, one of the things that really hurts is like, why me? Like, why why did this have to happen to me? Why is this my thing now? Someone else made a decision and now it's impacting me for the rest of my life. Great. Mm-hmm. And that same thing is felt by people who are even farther off. Like I'm thinking about like my mom. My mom is now carrying a trauma around with her of having to sit there and watch as her daughter was in prison for years for something she didn't do. And she has had to live with that and find a way to cope with that and can never like forgive herself for not having saved me from that. Like everyone is experiencing that lived trauma, and the way that we tell these stories impacts them too.
Yes. Well, and when it comes to consuming the content that's inevitably going to be made, there's something profound about watching, listening, something that the survivor has made, has put their stamp on. You know, the big question, Karen, I always come back to about, do you consume true crime as a survivor? You already answered. But for me, I typically don't. I will see a few of them if, like, my husband or I had involvement or whatever it might be. But when Kara's documentary came out, and we had been talking for a long time throughout that process, and I knew all the blood, sweat, and tears that went into it, there was this presence of mind that I was able to sit and, I don't want to say enjoy it necessarily, air quotes again, but
sure.
I sat there knowing every single thing. It. Yes. Yeah. Like I got to watch the story. I got to watch Kara kick ass on TV live and be able to consume that in a way that made me not just proud, but I was able to stop questioning whether or not it was something that she would have been comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Is it something that she's okay with? Did they say that right? Because I already knew that they did. Because she was involved from start to finish. She had that hand in the creation and ultimately that approval. And I think you'd have a lot more people who are willing to watch that kind of stuff.
Instead that does just, honor to the victim.
Yes.
Right?
Instead like, of just, I was a journalist in that area at the time. Mm-hmm. Let me narrate this for you.
And let me tell you yet another very like clear, like ABC, this is how we tell all these stories in the exact same way with the exact same takeaway. Like nobody learns anything from it.
Right.
Like,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Such a pain. But I just love that. And I want to see more of that. And that's a big reason I'm so excited about this miniseries that you have coming out, because
it's something
that I can sit and enjoy and know that you've got your stamp of approval on it because you were part of this from start to finish.
And like small, like little thing to look out there. I can't say what it is yet, but I am working on something pretty exciting along those lines. So, just stay tuned.
Yes, we will.
Keep an eye on all your socials.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's funny. Like one of the things that I've found is as I talk to consumers of true crime, because let's be realistic, most of my social media audience is going to be people that consume true crime, right? Like that's where they come from. And as I talk to them about how to ethically be a conscious consumer of true crime content, they're just like, what? Like, I never heard of that. It's like, I know. That's why we're having conversations, because if you're not considering, like, why are these people telling these stories? What are they doing to give back to these communities that they're telling the worst day of their lives? Like, what are they doing calls to action? Are they consulting the victims and the victims' families? Are they getting consent? It's amazing. And the number of times, I'm sure you will relate to this, I open up YouTube or someone sends me a photo, a screenshot of when they open up YouTube, and they're like, I open up YouTube and here's your face. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I get tagged, and the worst is like someone tags me on social media of them like telling my story. I'm like, hey, you know what? Like, I'm pretty easy to get in contact with. Like, just reach out. Hey, I'm doing this thing. Is that okay with you? It's so interesting. And I'm so glad that there are people who are having these conversations and trying to open people's eyes. I think it's so important to continue having these conversations. And so everyone, definitely listen to Labyrinths and hear all of Amanda's hot takes, which are actually good hot takes. As opposed to-
I try not to have hot takes. I have really cold takes.
But I loved your piece that you just published in, it was Time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about Britney. Yeah.
I loved that because it offers a perspective that might fall on deaf ears if it's coming from anyone but someone who's been through it.
Yeah.
And we didn't even get to touch on the political things that go in back and forth. That's a whole other conversation that I would also love to hear. But that was a great piece. I know that this will come out a little after that, but check
that
out.
But people can check it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's linked, I know, on your stuff, and it'll be on your website, I'm sure.
Yep.
Thanks. But it does show the amount of thought and research and actual facts that go into what you do as a journalist today.
Yeah, and it matters. Truth matters. Mm-hmm. And like, and taking like, for those who are curious, like the I talk a lot about the politics and the publicity that goes into who gets attention, really, honestly, in the criminal justice world. And one of my, again, a lot of my like hot takes just come from reacting to other people's hot takes. And the big sort of reaction that I had from the hot takes about Brittany Griner being brought home from an insane detention situation in Russia was people saying like, she's not worth it. And I like, I just, the last thing that someone who has gone through a tremendously horrible, traumatizing experience needs to hear is that whatever mercy they have been and whatever consideration and support that they have received was undeserved, and that she wasn't worth it somehow. Like, it just bothered me so much. And it's like, yes, there are a lot of people out there who also deserve it, who are not getting it. But does that mean that we should be like shaming somebody who has just been through what is probably the worst experience of her life as she's just coming home? Where it's going to like, she's already experiencing survivor's guilt. Let's like be clear. She knows that not everybody gets saved by the U.S. government. And the last thing that she needs to hear from you jerks is that she's not worth it. So,
I mean, I don't see how you could take such compounded trauma and hear something like that and not think that it's about you as a human and your worth, not even just the mercy or support or the politicization, but how do you not think about that as you as a person?
Yeah.
And that's not what we need to be doing here.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners where they can find you, what you're up to now, all of the things so that they can connect and follow you for these announcements.
Oh, well, thank you. So my husband and I have a podcast called Labyrinths that you can get anywhere you listen to podcasts. We post all of our work on our website, knoxrobinson.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Amanda Knox and on Instagram at Amama Knox. So any announcements that I have can be found there. It's exciting times.
If you've got somewhere that you want to direct people to help to pay attention to get involved.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so many ways that people can get involved in all of this incredible work. I definitely would steer people towards Lenora Claire and what she's doing with trying to uplift victims of crime. Another thing, another organization which is amazing that nobody knows about is called Healing Justice, founded by Jennifer Thompson, who was a survivor of rape. But who accidentally implicated the wrong person, and eventually DNA showed who was the actual rapist and all of that. And she has this incredible healing organization where she brings victims of crime and victims of the criminal justice system together into a healing space where everyone can learn from each other's experiences. So Healing Justice is something I would recommend people look into. Of course, I always support all of the Innocence Projects. And one thing to know about the Innocence Project is that there are all of these local ones. It's not like the Innocence Project covers all of the cases of innocence throughout the United States and around the world. There are individual ones in almost every state. So definitely look into your local Innocence Project and just pay attention. You know, like so much happens on a local level. And it's really about paying attention to who we put into power and the stories that are being told in our various spaces and holding people who have the power over people's lives and freedom and their life stories and the worst experience of their lives. Like, who do we give that power to? And are we holding them accountable? So the long, rambly call to action.
Well, I feel like there's so much we didn't even get to touch on here. And I would love for everyone to check out your podcast because I know that you go into a lot more detail on so many topics too.
Yeah. So, and you know what? Let's do this another time after you've had a few more awesome guests.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, guys. So it's been great.
To keep up and see what you're doing.
I imagine we'll have to revisit all of these
conversations. Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah, there's so much. This is an ongoing conversation. Yeah. Things are still going to happen. And I'm not difficult to reach, so it'd be great to stay in touch.
Well, thank you so much for having the time to do this and talking with us and sharing your perspective with our listeners. We really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing it.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.